Today's program is brought to you by Brooklyn Slate. BrooklynSlate.com for more.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Pleasure.
This is Amanda Dell, lead producer of Food Book Fair. We were so excited to talk about food and visual culture because it's really a topic that has saturated the food conversation, I would say, over the past couple of years. You have new people in the game creating beautiful Instagram shots of food, and it's kind of like the idea of, well, if we don't Instagram it, did it ever happen? And then having that in contrast with people who, you know, started the whole food styling movement and creating a beautiful tablescape and arranging food in a particularly aesthetically pleasing way that started doing that for still photography. And we wanted to really just bring all of those people into the conversation about bringing food, you know, off of the plate and onto your screen or camera.
Hey, everybody. I think we're just settling down. Hopefully the last people are through the door. I know this is going to be a hot one. So if some folks don't mind standing in the back, and we're going to shut the door and we're going to get this started, because this is our last panel of the evening. It's about food, representations of food in visual culture. And we have some really amazing panelists and one really amazing moderator on hand on stage for you this evening, Michael Harlan Turkell. I know you guys all have a lot of fans in the audience, so everyone please cheer and clap. Allison Attenborough. Woo! Andrea Gentle. And Camille Becerra, last but not least. I'll let Michael kick it off. Excellent. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Actually, I want to be a big round of applause for Kim for doing such an amazing job, you know, helping put the Food Book Fair together. You think I know how to do this for being on podcasts for so long, but no. Thank you, everyone, for coming. This is a wonderfully packed house. But the first thing I want to do is have everyone close their eyes. I mean it, like, close your eyes. And truthfully, this is nothing more than making me feel better, because I usually don't have an audience looking at me. It's not about visualizing anything. You can open your eyes again. Okay, we're all at a good place. This is a really cool panel. Obviously, I work at the intersections of food, art, and design. I have a podcast called The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm a photographer, so I couldn't be happier to have these three wonderful ladies with me who kind of run the gamut of what food is in visual culture. We have Allison Attenborough, a fantastic stylist. We have Andrea Gentle, an amazing photographer. And then Camille Becerra, who kind of does it all, a chef, owns Navy, has food style. But, you know, I don't even want to talk about the image itself at first. I kind of want to touch on the words, the sounds, the onomatopoeias that make you want to eat something, make you crave a specific food. What are those descriptive terms that really make you want to get a dish or, you know, cook a meal?
I would say for me, spicy. I like anything spicy because for me, when I think of spice, I think visually of Thai food and Asian food, which to me is the most visually interesting because it has a lot of colors. And then to eat it, it's got a lot of textures. So for me, when I think of something tasty, I think of a cold drink and spicy food.
And Andrea?
I think of lush, green, verdant, spicy, woody, those kind of things.
All the whys.
Foraged, mossy. Yeah.
Camille?
I think where it lies for me is seeing certain combinations of different flavors that are being utilized in a way that I didn't think about. That's always an attraction in terms of like what I want to eat, like different combinations of things.
Because it was fun. I was reading your menu for Navy, which is a wonderful restaurant in Soho, if you haven't been. And it was a side that actually caught my eye the most, is the word charred. And I believe it was a charred cabbage side. And, you know, you think of charred and you see black and smoky and you have this, you know, dark carbon taste. But how words represent images, simply on a menu, you have this in your mind's eye. Do you ever work from literature? Do you ever read a book and kind of try to, you know, visualize a scene out of that and build?
Actually, it's funny that you chose this subject and thought about chard, because I have a good friend who's a prop stylist, and he likes a lot of dark, he's not a dark person, but he likes very dark images visually. And so funny enough, he said, I want to do something that's my style with a lot of dark things and burnt wood and burnt things. So we actually did a test called chard, and we did a lot of like where you char your oranges, you dry them out in the oven and then you char them. And so quite literally we followed that theme. And then we did a charred cabbage, and we did charred, I think we did cheeses that had ash, because visually, I thought visually. So I was trying to think of things that have the ash in the cheese and lots of textures along with that theme. So that's how I interpreted that.
Yeah. I mean, is there ever one word that kind of expands itself into a bigger scene, a scenario?
I think there's always a bigger word. I mean, when you're talking to art directors, they often have one word that you're working off of for a story. For Lady Magazine, we worked off the idea of black for this whole black food story. And so we had chard, we had black salt. We thought of all the things we could possibly bring in, the black chicken from Chinatown and all those kinds of things. And then the food stylist sort of worked with that and expanded on it.
Black squid ink, yeah.
I mean, it's these interactions, I think, with art directors, and Camille, you know this as being a food stylist and having been on TV, there are these points or these directions that people give you to create a foodscape. What are words or directions that don't work? I mean, I hate the word unctuous right now, just because unctuous, I mean, has many meanings, but I think more like viscous and oily rather than, you know, lush and gooey. What are words that you try to dissuade?
Whether it be like doing a dish or more in food styling?
Either or.
I don't know. I think I always kind of want to sort of evoke a feeling or a situation more than a word, I think. And usually when I am working with people, I think I'm most sort of creative when there is a story that that person wants to share. So I think it's more of like trying to set a scene and really have the viewer sort of take what they take from this photo and create a story from it.
Well, let's set a scene, because I know you spent some time with monks.
Yeah.
Zenning out, you know, listening to the... Is zenning out a term?
Well, and nowadays, and making a lot of tofu.
Yeah, making a lot of tofu. I mean, obviously, we can all visualize what that looks like, but what did it feel like to you? What were the elements?
Well, I was very young, and it was really one of my first culinary jobs. And when you're a young cook, you basically will do anything. And I was in a position where I was traveling and stumbled on this place that needed a cook. It was, you know, it was in a beautiful place, and I'd come from a very urban childhood, so it was very lush. There was a lot of, there was gardens and vegetable gardens and hot springs, and so it was sort of like a bit of a paradise for, you know, a kid from Elizabeth, New Jersey.
I mean, it sounds so stunning, but then I think, how do you represent that in a dish?
Well, they were very particular about what food they wanted to eat, and it was all vegetarian, and it was, you know, it had to come from the garden, and it had, you had to have grains at every meal, and you had to have, you know, there was a vegetable and then a protein, and mostly like vegetarian protein, so tofu, a lot of.
See, let's workshop this. Allison, Andrea, say if we were in a meeting and you were presented with Camille's story, how would you go to build out, you know, either horizontal or vertical frame, a six-page spread? What is the impetus of, you know, recreating a shoot?
So you could recreate that in many ways. So you might talk, the art director would give you, say, that background, and then you would think of tofu, I guess, and then you might think, mainly what, visually, to me, what starts often a shoot is the background or the wall. To me, I'm thinking of the monastery sort of wall, and maybe it's got some ivy and maybe it's gray, or so the color palette. We might talk about the color palette. So the color palette might be all muted earth and gray tones, and then that tofu is really white, so you could think this story could be very monochromatic. Or maybe you want to make it very different and you want to make it very graphic, because tofu comes in blocks. Or maybe in this monastery the tofu's homemade and it's all in beautiful vessels, or being strained, or there's so many ways. So you would talk to the art director, a prop stylist, a photographer. The photographer creates the mood and the lighting. So I really wish to talk to Andrea maybe about how she would see that lighting.
Yeah, once you get to that space, what do you do?
Well, it's funny because Camille and I actually created that tofu story together with Marty. We had just been in Nepal and we had this amazing fresh tofu. So I was telling her about it when we first met, and she told us about living in the monastery and making the tofu with monks. So we said, well, let's do that together. So we had just gotten these beautiful bowls from a collaboration we did with a potter in Denmark. And so that was, we knew we wanted them to be, we wanted to use those. And I don't know, we sat down, we brainstormed the recipes. We really didn't talk too much about the backgrounds or anything like that, but we knew we wanted those vessels. We made some recipes. Camille came over, and Marty kind of lit it. He's like the master sort of lighter. He's like a MacGyver. He doesn't go anywhere without his lighting, whether he uses it or not, and his rope.
Can you light us right now in better...
He probably has some rope hidden in his pocket. But we've kind of been into hard light lately and sort of shards of light that we're very inspired by from our travels, because that's what you really see. And that's part of being a photographer, is really being able to see light and then recreate it.
Well, it's being able to reinterpret a scene, share it with other people. And let's talk about traveling, because I've had private little email conversations with all of you. And I'll start with Allison, Jamaica.
I had been to Jamaica on a holiday, but that wasn't really how we got to talking about Jamaica. I have a friend who has a Jamaican restaurant, and he had come to me and said, I want some help in thinking about dinnerware. So we would ground the restaurant, and then how we would change the menu to make the food, because Jamaican food's very sort of, you know, you think of goat curry, you think of oxtail, things that are very brown, and how can you make that more appealing and easier to eat, because the tables are very small, and then they have rice and peas. So it was sort of like a very broad conversation. So then he said to me, well, you need to go to my restaurant in the East Village. And the theme, so it was this, you know, it was really difficult. Because his theme was Memphis meets 80s New York meets dancehall 80s music meets, you know. So I was like, okay, you know. So then I was like, I started, and I called a friend, and then I got this book on dancehall from the 80s. So I started listening to some music to get inspired. And then I looked at old Memphis, you know, catalogs of furniture, and they were beautiful knives and forks, and started to think. But it's very hard to reinterpret that in the sense of something for a restaurant that's readily available. But that's how I got into that Jamaica conversation.
Yeah, I mean, where do you go for inspiration? Because obviously you pull these books, and Andrea, I love your blog. If you don't know Hungry Ghost Food and Travel, please, please do. It's also really up to my covet list of things and, you know, experiences. But there's Pinterest, there's Instagram, there's hashtags. Why do you choose to have a personal blog that seems like your own diary?
Well, I started that blog sort of in a slow time after the whole recession. I had some time to kind of reevaluate what we were doing as far as work. Before that, we were shooting a lot of advertising. And while it was great for money, sometimes it wasn't as inspiring as you might really like. So I had some time to kind of think about what I wanted to put out there in the world. So I just started one day writing. I think I holed up in my room maybe for like a month and just worked on this. And then I started to put it out there little by little. And it's inspired by day-to-day life with our kids, traveling, other people that I find inspiring that I want to collaborate with. I think it's really important to have personal projects.
Yeah, I agree. If you don't have a personal project, go out and get one. Because if you... myopically, see, I hate being called a food photographer, and I'm sorry if this bursts someone's bubbles, but I'm a photographer and food happens to be a subject. So I think the more myopic you get, the more outside influences you don't end up seeing and being able to inflect your work with. So, you know, when you talk about what inspires you, I want to read Andrea's list. it's wonderful, but Pregnant Friends, Upstate Woods, The Color Gray, Travel to Far Off Places, My Neighborhood, Slow Food, Chocolate Makers, Nigel Slater, Brooklyn, River Cottage, Beekeeping, Farming, World Food Markets, Peruvian Sandwiches, Food Trucks, My Grandmother's Recipes, Italy, France, Mushrooms, Wild Crafting, Women's Cooperatives, Backyard Gardens, Cheesemakers, The Handcrafted food Movement, and that much more, type, language, history. But, you know, you don't have to, you know, photograph a pie by looking at pies. I mean, I'm sure we still do that same thing because of hashtags, but there's so much more out there. And Camille, you yourself are an image. And I was going to say image of beauty, which you are for sure. But you also project this image of yourself onto the world. How do you represent yourself as a food person? How do you want to show yourself? Is it through Instagram? Is it through the food you make?
I don't know that it's any of it. I just, you know, love what I do, and you know, I want to share what I love, and it's just as simple as that, really.
Well, let's talk about Navy, because I'm smitten with its maritime, you know, essence. I myself am a big fan of aquaculture and seafood, and walking in there, you're transported in a wonderful way. And how do you set up a scene? I mean, that restaurant is so specific and has such a setting and such a, you know, place. How did you conceptualize from the food up?
Okay, well, I had nothing to do with the design, so I can agree and say it is like a really special place and sort of a little bit of Wes Anderson meets downtown New York, and I love that so much about it. So it's very great to go to work and be somewhere beautiful. That's really important to me. I think that, you know, I love New York, and it's really as simple as just me wanting to do something in the city that I love with the people that I love. And I, in terms of seafood, I always thought that some of my, like most of my friends that only ate fish and vegetable were the most healthiest looking people ever. And, you know, and there is something to be said about sort of restricting yourself, in this case, just using vegetables and fish, that really inspire and you can really tap into that sense of creativity because you are restricted.
I love that word, restrictions, because otherwise you have too many ideas and too many thoughts. What are some of the best restrictions you all have set for yourself visually?
Visually, I think restraint, right? It's just to have things that are really simple and just kind of focus on the detail instead of the big picture, personally.
Yeah, I would agree, and I think it's about quality. Like the simplest thing often has the best quality, whether it's a garment, whether it's food, it's the purest form.
I think that's true, finding the best quality.
So what are those very simple things in life that you look at and you're just amazed as to how perfect and how photogenic and how stunning they already look without any kind of tinkering?
Mushrooms.
Oysters.
Oysters. I mean, so many things. There's so many. I don't know, I have a hard time editing, as you can tell from my list, so probably so many things.
But you mentioned, you know, oysters and mushrooms, right, which obviously have so many beautiful textures and tones. What are some of the more restrictive things to photograph or to style, like the harder, I know?
Well, I don't like to photograph corn on the cob or anything on a skewer or shrimp. I don't know why. Maybe raw shrimp is very nice, but cooked shrimp, I really don't like to shoot.
Yeah. What if they have the heads on? And
yeah, maybe. But definitely not on a skewer. I can't, I know. And no skewered meat with with peppers. I don't like peppers either.
So do not go to Andrea for your pepper book. Sorry.
I feel you could make a beautiful photo of a pepper in
a Western
Georgia
way. Yes, but
way.
Not a cut up.
Actually,
red
let's talk about Edward Weston. If you don't know this image, Edward Weston, a photographer in what, like the 50s and 60s, took black and white photographs of food, which is absurd nowadays with Instagram, and we try to take the most colorful, beautiful picture, but he turned them into such form. And guys, if you've ever been at a urinal, often you see a Carl Blossfeldt print staring you in the face. You know, these these really amazing flower photographs. I'm sure they happen outside of urinals as well, but you know, stripping things away, stripping color away and having pure form, it's just an amazing way to represent something as simple as a pepper. What are some of the more amazing formal or formalistic, you know, foods that you kind of love putting on plates or love photographing or love styling with?
Cheese is a great example, because there's so many types and textures and colors. You know, that's a simple form that photographs really well.
And it's very classic in old still life too. Cheese, birds, rabbits, things like that. Eggs. Oysters.
You know,
lobsters.
I realize we also have all these images flying by, and they're stunning, and it would be a shame if we weren't actually talking about a few of these. Right now, whose is this? Who do we have here?
That is a dish of that actually Nicole Franzen shot. It was a dish that I had very quickly at Navy because people just didn't get it. But it's so beautiful. It's bay leaves that are dipped in a batter, and you're meant to eat it almost like an artichoke. And sometimes something gets lost in translation and people would eat the bay leaf.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh no, you could actually choke off a bay leaf.
Yeah.
So it didn't last too long. But
well, it's kind of like seeing unnecessary garnish. I mean, as beautiful as it may seem to have a whole sprig of rosemary in it, like the function of it, actually my grandma used to just take them and put them in her purse. Know, and use that at home, thrifty Ashkenazis. But how often do you think about, oh, that would be so beautiful on a plate, and then have to tweak it and work and work it, and it just never works?
That's where I go back to restraint. I think that if you have this idea, or if you're at the market and you see something that is just peaking and beautiful, to highlight that and just make it a very simple dish, without using a lot of bells and whistles, like it tends to just usually work when you just keep it very simple.
So we've been talking a lot about, you know, food in general, but I want to talk about some of the technology that's really changed the game of visual culture as a whole. Obviously, Instagram and collectively hundreds of thousands of followers between the three of you. How important a tool is that for you personally and for you professionally?
I think it's a really important tool. It's a great marketing tool. It's like a visual Google, you know, for art directors, clients. I think, what was I going to say about this? Now I lost my train of thought. I think it's a really important tool, for sure.
Are you as on board with Instagram as the others?
These guys have hundreds of millions of followers. I have fewer followers.
See, that's why I clumped it all together. You didn't have to reveal that.
Yeah.
I think you did.
But I think it's an interesting, I think Instagram's fantastic. I think it's really great. And in some ways, I wish when I was younger, Instagram had been around, because I think I'm already a lot, you know, way along in my career, but I just think as a food or visual person in any field, it's like a fantastic showcase of your work. Whether you're an illustrator, a food stylist, a photographer, I mean, I look at all different stuff on Instagram and I think it's fantastic. I think the downside of Instagram is that people spend so much more time on their phones not listening to the news or not. That is a big time sucker, that you don't do these other things like converse in cafes, you look at Instagram, you know? I think that's the downside is that. But I think it's a brilliant, brilliant tool.
Yeah.
I think it's important, yeah. It ties so many things together. I've met really, really wonderful people that I've admired through Instagram. It closes the gap. It is... I'm completely inspired by people's photographs and lifestyle. I'm always learning about a new butcher shop here, or, you know, it fills me in on where I want to visit next in the world. I really use it, and I think it's very important.
Yeah, I think it's a great community builder. Also, it's a great tool for all of us who travel.
I mean, I don't personally use a lot of hashtags, but I know that people do, and that's how they search things, because it's really like this huge amount of metadata. I think that definitely clients are looking at Instagram and seeing what people are doing, and they might be watching people to see if their sort of story or whatever they're putting out there aligns with whatever their company, you know, visual is. And so they might hire people off Instagram.
Is Instagram personal at all, or do you feel like it's more a professional arm of your business?
I think it is sort of professional, but also a little bit personal. I think everybody has these Instagram personalities, and there's this whole idea of perfection, and Instagram isn't really quite real. There's definitely like a veil there. You know, there's a bit of voyeurism. It's not quite real. We all know Instagram's not really real. No one's life is that amazing or beautiful or perfect. And, you know, so I think that, but that's where we are. That's just where we are as a culture right now. And so we're putting all these filters on everything to make everything look even more beautiful, but not so real.
Okay, I'm going to bring it up again, the mood, because life is wonderful. Life is great. Styling, props. There's so much that goes into an image, too, that Instagram isn't as kind of fleeting as certain people think. I mean, you guys engage in it in a way that even Instagram seems very styled. Is that clips of your real life, or are you looking for intentional things to photograph or, you know, to put on Instagram?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, when I'm working in the kitchen and I'm doing something and I'll just think, hey, this is such a beautiful thing that I'm working with, and I feel very lucky, and so I will capture it just as like a moment of my life, whereas there's other things that, you know, need a little bit more nudging, and so they are a bit more composed.
Whose life is this?
That is Nicole Bronson and I's life again. Backyard barbecue.
I mean, how much of this did you have to tweak once the, you know, table was set?
Well, we had a prop stylist.
All that mud, she was, Australia.
She was there eating, so she brought some plates.
We should all just have our own personal prop stylist. I mean, talking about props, I'm shooting a book next week all about food and bowls, and prior to this week, I had a nominal amount of bowls at the house, and now I am just tumbling over bowls and bowls and bowls and bowls. Do you have your own props? Do you have go-to tabletops, linen, surfaces that you always love photographing on or styling with?
Definitely. I definitely have my own props.
Yeah.
I have a lot of bowls and a lot of spoons. Mm-hmm. Seem to collect a lot of spoons. I think we have our closet of props and tabletop things that we use. We have surfaces that we're constantly making. I make a lot of surfaces. We are always like stopping on the street and finding something, picking something up. Marty found an amazing table in the meatpacking district recently. We were on our way to a Bon App shoot, and that's what we used for the shoot. We lugged it in there, and it was perfect. So, yeah, we definitely have our go-tos.
Professional hoarders.
Yeah.
I mean, what are some of the, I know, Camille, you have just the most bespoke aprons and jackets at Navy. That's obviously an aesthetic decision to have those things there. What are some of the companies that you like working with that share that aesthetic?
Well, our coats there are made by a company called Lady and Butler, and they do a lot of uniforms for restaurants and hotels. And our uniform basically is just a vintage, is a design from a vintage French work coat. And aprons, I mean, I always love like a very soft apron. And so I love Birdcage. Like, she makes nice linen and sort of like indigo, very soft linens, aprons. So those are my two.
How often, I mean, I do this, and maybe I'm a freak, and you can tell me now, but I go to every restaurant, and I flip over plates. You know, I look at labels, and you know, write it down in my little pad. And I want those for myself, but I also keep this catalog of things that I want to use in shoots and imbue different, you know, textures and styles. Obviously, outside of food, there are a lot of inspiration. What are the textiles? What are the patterns that you look towards or you feel like are trending these days?
I mean, there's definitely a sort of Southwestern influence in a lot of, like, Aztec prints and prints like that. And then a lot of, like, people are doing really beautiful, like, they're, you know, going back to weaving and weaving stuff. So I'd say there's a lot of weaving going on. And then natural dyeing. I would say those are sort of trends in linens mm-hmm. right now.
And ceramics are obviously really big, sort of organic ceramics, forms and shapes.
And big. Indigo is a huge thing, indigo. Like tie-dyeing and regular indigo yeah. and stuff.
How worried do you get that these things hit a fever pitch, you know, that everyone has handmade ceramics or everyone's, I mean, you look at fashion and everyone's in indigo this year.
Well, I think there is a mix out there for sure. I mean, if you look at Squirrel in LA, she's using all those old, like, grandma plates, you know, that, and they look amazing. So maybe that's going to be the next thing after the beautiful ceramics. And then in the Time Life images I pulled, there were sort of these tacky carnations, but lately I've been seeing them popping up in some of these, you know, newer food magazines, some like Brutal or whatever, and they look great. So yeah, maybe that's sort of...
What are some of those cyclical trends? We were talking before about your first book that you ever shot was with Julia Child, mm-hmm. Baking with Julia by Dori Greenspan. What were some of the props that you used there, and do you still have them hoarded in your closet?
Well, my friend Julia actually styled that job. But we probably have some of our own stuff in there, too. I think we used a lot of ironstone. We used a lot of white linens. It was sort of what was trending at that time, I think, though we never used that word. That's a new word, trending. I think some of the photography in Baking with Julia is definitely still really on point. But then there was a majority of it that was sort of softer focus that nobody really does anymore, unless you're just doing kind of handheld short depth of field. So I feel like it's... you know, still kind of similar.
I mean, let's go back to technology. How much has new equipment changed how you photograph? New cameras, new lenses, new computers?
I think that's changed incredibly. I mean, we used to shoot everything with a 4x5 Sinar, which was just giant, and we really liked it because it had tilt-shift capabilities and swing capabilities, so if we had things on different planes, we could control the focus. And then now with digital, everything's really on a flat plane unless you use these tilt-shift lenses, but they don't really have the swing. So you're sort of limited. They also don't have, you know, capability to be super big files, so then you have to go back to these older systems with these newer backs. It's complicated. I think I spend so much more time now on the computer and doing file management and editing than I ever did before. When we first started, we would, you know, work until probably 7 or 8 at night, and then the lab was like on our street. We would go and drop off the film. We'd go back and pick up something called a clip test, which was the first few frames of our film, and we'd see how it looks, and we would adjust the exposure for the development. And then we would go back at midnight and pick it up, and then we'd start all over the next morning. But now I just feel like I'm tied to my computer, and I have a herd of hard drives that just like follows me everywhere. It's like my Jacob Marley chains.
You know, why can't they be more fashionable?
Yeah, they're just, it's just too much. There's too much data.
Yeah. I mean, you were talking about, you know, tweaking files and being able to deal with that management, but tilt shift specifically, you know, it, which I also know as the Schleimflug maneuver, mm-hmm. which
it's
everyone...
It's a great word,
it's Schleimflug. Schleimflug. It's so great. Mm-hmm. But on Instagram, it has these filters. It has these techniques built in that are obviously based off of very analog things with bellows. And I see people using that on Instagram, and it's conveying almost this analog era of photography, which I think is very funny, compacted into this little screen. Do you think we're still connected to thinking about analog when we're shooting digitally? Or do you think Instagram is its own world?
Well, I think Instagram's definitely its own world, and a lot of people using those filters don't really have any idea, you know, the origins of, you know, where they even really came from.
But this new generation, I guess, you know, whatever, millennials, they are very tied to analog photography. And even our daughter, who's 17, she's just all about that. So I think we are still going to see that quite a bit. But you know, the filters that represent film, everybody loves those.
So you pick your own filters, you pick your own style and look. I want to talk a little about building yourself as a brand visually, because there's continuity, obviously, in your images, Camille, and your food, and Allison, in the way that you style. What are words that you would use to describe yourself?
Wow, that's a tough one. I can't actually think how I'd describe myself. In terms of my work,
yeah.
I like a fair number of things. So in terms of my work style, my personal style of what I like is, I like fashion. I'm interested in fashion. I like to look at fashion magazines also for inspiration. I like a lot of fashion photography, a lot of fashion photographers' lighting. I think you can be inspired, and I think the food world in a way and the fashion world are getting closer and closer together in terms of, you know, it used to be that food is just much more accessible to people now. And then I think the whole thing with food as a fashion is that people in the restaurant world are much more conscious of how they look. And you mentioned in the brief, Marco Pierre White, who was mm-hmm. the first fashionable chef. So I think that's interesting.
It's funny with that book too, White Heat, that he chose an unfashionable way of photographing it. You know, again, that was black and white. It was shutter speeds that showed action in blur. And only later did they re-release that book with color images of food. When you approach a cookbook these days, how do you get outside of what everybody else is doing and make that its own thing?
Well, that is, I guess you want to choose projects that you're really inspired by, so you can get out of the box there. I mean, recently we did Heartwood with Eric Werner in Tulum, and we spent the majority of our first trip there not even shooting any food, just riding around the Yucatan with him and meeting all his, you know, honey, is the guy who does his honey, and the person who's building his oven in the forest, and we were hiking miles into the jungle. And I think you want to work with people that are really passionate, who have a great story, because the behind-the-scenes kind of story is as important as what ends up on the plate in the end, and you hope that it finds itself into the book. And then we worked with Jody Williams. It was kind of the same thing with her, with Bouvette. She was very inspired by ingredients and her props, and just Bouvette has a great sense of place and style. So we tried to work that in as well, and I think that came across in that project. So I think it's, you know, it's choosing the right projects for you and not taking everyone just because it's offered to you.
The word collaborators again, and the importance of that. Who are some of your favorite people to work with, and why do you choose to work with them? Everybody.
Okay.
Hopefully you guys work.
We've all worked together.
Yeah.
And a lot of you out there, we've worked, I see a lot of familiar faces.
Yeah. I think it's great to work with people regularly because you can build a style together, mm-hmm. and it's really great to collaborate with people who have great ideas. I think for me, I work sometimes with Marcus Nielsen. I think he's a fantastic photographer that is always evolving and changing. Having known him for a while, his work changes a lot. And he's definitely inspired by very different things, and he brings a lot of that to his lighting or his idea for that day.
I wish I could work with Marcus because he is very inspiring.
You could work with
thing,
Marcus.
Photographers never get to work with other photographers, but we definitely have our crew of stylists that we really like to work with, and we've worked with them for so many years. And maybe you choose one person for one thing because they might be more appropriate for a certain job, or a stylist who might be more rustic, somebody else is like a little more modern. So you choose from your pool of people. And the pool in New York, it's not really so big, even though you think it really would be. It's not really that big. There are far more photographers than there are stylists and food stylists.
Camille, who do you love working with? I know you have a little crew that sits out on the benches in front of the Navy all the time.
Well, being a young cook in New York City, it's very hard. You know, you don't get paid a lot. And our kitchen is a small galley kitchen at Navy. And so, you know, if you need something, you just basically just have to reach over your shoulder onto the shelf and grab it. Like, it's so small. So I choose people that have a really good way of being, that are fun, that don't stress out, that aren't angry, you know. And so luckily it's a small space, and I can pick and choose who I work with. I think with anything food stylistically, I mean, Andrew and Marty, I love so much. You know, it's so beautiful to watch them work. You know, she's they're both wonderful photographers, but Andrea sort of creates this mood, and it's gorgeous. And then Marty, as we mentioned before, is a master of light, and it's just like really beautiful to watch him light her beautiful, you know, compositions.
He's MacGyver.
Yeah, and he'll have like a piece of cardboard over there, and like, I don't know, some like little bulb over here, and you're just like, how is that gonna work? But it does. Like, I don't know how he does it.
It's lo-fi.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're seeing all these final products, all these, you know, beauty shots, but really a lot of people want to see what happens behind the scenes, and maybe you guys would be willing to share that someday on Instagram, you know, pulling back from what's actually right in front of you and show the bigger picture, because it's
like
so
that.
Funny to think of, you know, where people photograph and what they end up with when all this other chaos is happening around them. I mean, it's such a funny ramshackle thing, but let's hashtag this two steps back. Like, and just take two steps back and show us how everything is being set up and how everything looks before the final product.
Never happened.
No? Don't want to take
no,
that veil.
I feel like lighting is super proprietary, and though we all do similar things, you know, that's our thing, and that's the one thing that we have that might set us apart from Marcus or, you know, Martin Thompson or Nicole or whatever. So we try to keep that veil boxed in, and we don't really let anyone in. One time we had someone on set, and she was just trying to get in there and take pictures, and we were on set with Bon App with Alex, and we built this cave, and it kept getting like smaller and smaller, and he said, so then he Instagrammed the cave. Said, what are you guys doing over there? And we said, well, actually, we're keeping that person out. And we're super open about, you know, our assistance, and there's full disclosure. If you're on our set, you're part of our family, and you're there usually there for many, many years. But it's just like that's the one thing that we might have is our lighting. So we kind of try to keep that. So that probably isn't going to happen, but you might see the box.
No, I completely respect the honesty of that, because it really is hard with such a saturated market of photographers to make yourself special and distinct.
Right.
And, you know, obviously part of it's your drive, but it's also some of that technical prowess that you have too. And you learn and you build. And the way to really learn that for yourself would be, and I'm letting you guys fill in the blank, is it just keep on shooting, keep on trying, keep on experimenting?
Well, yeah, keep on shooting, keep on pushing the button, just try things. And when you're out there in the world and you see some beautiful shaft of light and like Renard's, and you're taking your iPhone and you're shooting it, then think about that when you're back, you know, in your room, in your studio, wherever you are, and try to recreate that. You have natural light you can work with, or you have all different kinds of, you know, strobes or hot lights, and you just have to play and experiment, and that's kind of what we've done all these years. We started out heavily shooting natural light, and then you know, we had to light things because days were long and you couldn't always rely on the weather. So I think people have to know how to light for sure if you want to work commercially and you want to, you know, you can't be 2 o'clock in the winter and you're calling it quits because that doesn't work with your clients. So
yeah. I mean, and you have control that way too. There are so many places
yeah,
to photograph
control, sure.
and, you know, be in the city, and most photographers cover south, if not southwest light, if they're natural light shooters. But you don't always have that. You know, you can't always expect that of yourself. So to create something consistent, you have to be able to have that kind of control.
And you can start to see what kind of light you like. If you like that harsh sunlight, you might go for a southern studio or a west studio. If you like that sort of Dutch Flemish thing, you might go for a northern studio. And, you know, you just kind of figure it out.
The last question I really want to ask is more about collaborating, but the designers. You know, when you're talking layout with a magazine or a book and there's maybe type or there's something close to the well, how do you discuss that with them? How do you visually interpret the page before the page is laid out?
Well, we always ask them now if there's any type on the photograph, if they have the digital files, the digital specs for our tech, and then we're usually dropping the type, you know, the layout right over the pictures. I guess that's kind of how it goes. I mean, we don't really have any say in where the type goes or anything like that.
I mean, do you get that from a style sense? Do you get to have final designs on set while you're...
No, generally there'll be an art director, someone from the magazine, from the, you know, from the ad agency, and they know where their type needs to go. So we know that our food, you know, needs to be cropping in that corner or in that corner, and the type's going here or there. So generally not. But that... It's interesting because we were talking earlier, the art director on most shoots has a big say and is a big participant in a photo shoot, which on Instagram they're obviously not there. That's our thing. But on a regular shoot, the art director is the sort of the main person that leads all of us, I would say.
And that's back to that restraint, too. Mm-hmm. You know, being able to have that big skill set and that control... obviously, you can shoot a variety of things, a variety of different ways, but when you meet that art director who says, I want it like this, you better be able to do it like that.
Yeah, you have to do it that way, even if you don't want to, but you can always say, well, I'll do it that way, but I like this too, can we try that? And then maybe, you never know, it might end up being that one that they chose. So it's always good to be accommodating.
I always say shoot for your clients first, but make sure you walk away with something for yourself as well. I want to open up to some questions for the panel today, too. I'm sure there are a few. Or is everyone as shy as we are? Come on. Right there.
So I'm curious, you mentioned about the trend in more of the dark visual style and dark photography. I mean, for all of you, I'm curious, if you think about, you know, on one side, maybe it's a certain bias towards the composition, or whether it's a personal preference, like a color tone or some kind of style that you really feel like is a personal favorite or kind of a trademark question. I'm curious how you portray that yourself.
For me, what I've brought visually often to a photo shoot is that I travel a lot and I work in San Francisco. And whenever I travel, I'd be inspired by certain things I found. So, for example, the farmers market in San Francisco is way ahead of what we ever had in New York because of their climate. So they had watermelon radishes and they'd have flowering plants and stuff like that. So I would hide stuff in my suitcase and bring it back. And those were my personal elements that I could add to a shoot. And then in terms of whether it's sort of darkness or light, that would come generally, say, from a photographer. My personal thing is I actually like quite light stuff. I like quite either sometimes very harsh lighting or things that are very white. So it's quite interesting to collaborate with somebody who likes everything to be black and dark and painted his whole apartment black. You know, it's a whole other realm. But and it really depends on the photography. I could say that my preference is light and white, but then when you work with a really great photographer and you do something really moody and dark and beautiful, that can also change your opinion of what you think you like. And you can go through periods where you're into a light sort of image and then it changes, you know.
Another question, right behind.
Well, I really like that, and I think it ties back to a lot of art history, paintings and film. I love the Time Life series books from the 50s, 60s, 70s. My grandmother had those. I love to look at those. Or old French cookbooks.
there are these crazy, I think I pulled one, but I don't know if you put it up, but there was sort of this towering picture of fruit in sort of very muted, like 1950s tones, and I feel like that's very Brutal magazine right now. When I saw it, I felt like it was very similar. I mean, I like that. I like that things are always changing and evolving. I think it's amazing that there are all these new magazines out there and everyone's so inspired and self-publishing, and I know how much work it takes to do it, so, yeah.
Actually, Allison, I think you and I were talking about people being able to have independent magazines and how important that is right now, and, mm-hmm. you know, how great a release it is, too, that you can actually produce this thing that a lot of people can see. I mean, what are some of the other indie magazines that you look at for inspiration?
Gather is so beautiful. Diner Journal, one of the, you know, yeah. first.
And then there's a lot of hand illustrated ones now that are really beautiful. Like there's How to Put an Egg on It.
Right, How to Put an Egg on It is great.
And there's a lot of humor in those, like in Lucky Peach, for example.
Right.
There's humor there, which I quite like.
I mean,
well.
You only had to have been at the Foodie Articles to see, like, there are just so many. So inspiring, and the printing is really beautiful. I mean, there's Lady Magazine, which is more fashion, but she's really interested in doing food as well. I don't know, so many.
That's a question.
How do you feel about
food imagery and motion?
You mean like videos and... Yeah, actually, this is a great question, because I know as a photographer, a lot of the time they ask you, well, can you shoot a video of that too? Like, it's the same thing.
It's a very different process. As a food stylist, it's very different. Because if you're working, say, on a film, for example, like I worked on Titanic years ago, and you would have to have something, say, that could sit there for 6 days, or you might have to do 60 takes on something. So they would shoot from one end of the table looking that way and then the other end of the table. So it's a very, very different process. Stills and film, I think, are very different. I mean, video, the simple video, Andrea probably shoots that, but the simple video where you're shooting somebody preparing one dish step to step is maybe that most like a still shoot in a way, but film is very, very different.
I mean, it's something you don't think about, but when you have to do video, your backgrounds need to be much bigger to do a pan or... You know, it's totally different. So you just can't sort of substitute in there and everybody just wants to do video. We used to do a lot of video on the fly, but then we found that we really didn't like the quality of what was happening. It's very distracting to have to shoot the still job and the video. So now we work with a production company and we act more as like the directors. So we did something for Haagen-Dazs and Marty did the still set and I did the video set and we had a red with super slow motion, and I got to do all this fun, like falling chocolate and breaking eggs, and it was just amazing. I mean, I really loved it, but I like having a technician there because honestly, it's totally different. And those bigger cameras that you need for commercials, they're totally different, and I don't really know how to use them. So I feel like a little bit of that trend of photographers just shooting the video has shifted a little bit now. And we're acting more as maybe directors.
Actually, Camille, do you feel like you cook differently when you are on Top Chef, like for a video or an action camera rather than a still?
Well, I mean, Top Chef was a complete, like, oddball sort of experience in terms of cooking. One being, you know, you're put into this kitchen, you don't know the kitchen, you don't know how the equipment works, you don't know where the things are. And that's just basically, I mean, that was just like, playing a game, really, a really bad game. I also shoot a lot of video and did a lot of my own sort of quirky instructional videos and did like instructional videos where you basically just see my hand for other companies and magazines. I think when you're doing these small videos, you really are just cooking and you're talking to whoever's shooting it and so that they know the process, et cetera, and what you're going to get into. And so you can just do it in one take. That's what I like to do. So you inform the person shooting it, hey, this is going to happen. And we just kind of, you know, go through with it.
I feel that same way whenever I shoot a cookbook. You know, we have our meeting with what recipes are we going to shoot, but we go through the recipe. I say, well, hold that off. We're going to need, you know, extra garnish for that. And I'm sure you've all had those conversations. And often chefs will just be like, no, I'm just going to cook it like I cook and give it to you. But that's not really, it's not going to represent itself in the same fashion. Because, you know, you drop a plate on the table for a diner, it's supposed to exist for a minute, if that. But you put it in front of a photographer, they want a little more latitude, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And you have to know how things evolve, how things, you know, degradate too.
Yeah, I think that's the most frustrating thing doing food sometimes. Like, I had a very frustrating week last week because I was working on an ad job where we would make a food dish and then we would have to wait for feedback from another source, from another office. So they would send the image and then they would get back a day later. So essentially you had to recreate everything again. So you just got more and more behind. You know, that's an interesting thing because food, you know, deteriorates really quickly. And a good food photographer and a good art director and a good client knows that. So they know that you want to shoot the thing when it's in its prime and looking the most beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I suppose a frustrating thing is when people don't understand that.
Right, when the client isn't on set and you're waiting for the emails to come back. But can I say something about collaboration again?
Yes, please.
I just want to say that, you know, our part of the job, it's really small. I mean, everyone who comes to that set, you know, looking out, I see Dimity and Steven. And basically, every person who comes to set brings something, and it's a huge collaboration. I mean, everything we do is a collaboration every single day, from our assistants to the studio manager to the art directors to the stylists. Everybody puts a piece of that together, and that's really what this whole job is about. It's about how we all work together, and collaboration is the most important part. And we could never just take credit for, you know, one of those pictures. It's the moving parts that really created it, it's all the people. And then when the job is over, you know, we walk out of the studio, but if it's for like a big client or even if it's for a magazine, they then go back to, you know, their offices or wherever they flew in from, and they have to maybe spend like weeks or months with those images. And it's really important that we all do the best job that we can while we're on set because it's so important to them. You know, they're spending their clients' money, and they have to take it back, and everyone has to believe in it and have done the best job. And so that's how we all kind of collaborate. And it's super important to, you know, work with people. Right? Wouldn't you say, Mark? Collaboration.
a last question. Right back there.
I don't know. What are they doing wrong? Do you have thoughts about that?
I think maybe using too much filter as well.
Yeah, I would say it's about the lighting. Like, I'm with friends and they all want to take their Instagram pictures at dinner. And most of the time you really can't take the picture at dinner because you're not in daylight. And particularly for food, it definitely looks better when you take it in daylight. So I would say the number one thing I think a lot of Instagrammers might do wrong is to take pictures in bad light in a restaurant. That'd be something that I would think.
A lot of times now with Instagram, everything that goes out there, none of us are able to restrain ourselves. You know, we see something beautiful, we have to put it out there right away. And there's no more time to just like let things lie or simmer. And I was talking to somebody today, and I think it's really important. You know, I need to work on this myself. If I have a personal project, I need to restrain it a little bit, because once you put it out there, it's just out there. And then other people start maybe picking up on that, being influenced by it, maybe taking the same picture, and it becomes so far removed from the source, you know, that it's just out there. And sometimes it's important to just keep those things back a little bit and let them simmer. As far as what do people do wrong, I don't know, maybe overly filter, I don't know.
I know that you don't like a blurry picture too.
No, I don't like blurry pictures on Instagram. I do often do screenshots of people's pictures and blow them up to see how sharp they are. I don't know.
That's so funny.
I don't know, I'm kind of obsessed with sharpness. I do, yeah, I'm very still. I take several pictures of the same picture. If it's not sharp, I won't put it up. I don't know.
I don't love blurry pictures. Or short depth of field, I think sometimes amateur photographers maybe don't use a tripod where they really could, and that's maybe the one tool that would be, you know, amazing if they used it, because then they're not like opening their aperture wide open in some dark place and it's just not looking great.
But then I have something to say to that. Isn't Instagram supposed to be instant?
And you should Instagram, yes, but professional photographers, you know, mm-hmm. Who are, you know, everybody has a digital camera now, so now everyone's kind of a photographer, but really everyone has a phone or something, a smartphone, so that's, everyone's a photographer. I mean, right?
So I'm a terrible photographer on my Instagram.
Really?
I don't know, and maybe it's because I sit there, well, I also just mainly take pictures of my cat.
Oh.
But again, you were saying something really important. You know, it's out there, and I would rather have time to, you know, ponder it and see where it fits in a sequence and build a story out of it. And, you know, these moments pass, and I always go, damn it, I should have taken a picture of that. But at the same time, maybe it wasn't the right thing to take a picture of and, you know, release into the world as part of my portfolio. So I think of Instagram as a very personal, you know, less professional platform, because as a photographer, I want to show them what I can do with a camera, not with a phone.
I also think it's really interesting. I mean, years ago, photography, like jobs that you would be doing, editorial jobs, the editorial lineups were completely secret. Like Food and Wine, they didn't want to, you know, Martha didn't want to know what, you know, they probably wanted to know, but they didn't know what they might be shooting. And so now, I don't know. I think there's this whole trend. It's just changed. There's like a free-for-all. It's Wild West on most sets. People are just Instagramming and saying, hey, I'm doing this amazing egg shoot for this magazine, for the May issue. And it's really strange to me, because that was always top secret. And I don't know if it's because the magazines
Bon Appetit
want...
don't let you do that.
No, they don't. But several others, it looks like they do. And I'm curious if... maybe they just want the followers of those people and they're just looking the other way, or if it's just completely, you know, gone out and thrown out.
I don't know. There's something wonderful about suspense that sometimes gets lost in the Instagram world, that, you know, the willingness to wait, you know, and to have your own idea of what something's going to look like and then see that product, and it may be nothing like it, but that you get, it's like, you know, opening a present at Christmas. And I think we kind of miss that in this world, that, you know, obviously cookbooks take a year to come out after they're finished, but we know way too much about them at first. And everyone's sharing photos of food at restaurants. It's like, oh, I want to go there and eat that. But sometimes I like being surprised. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, I don't have AMC, so I don't read anything about Mad Men on Sundays or Mondays until I can watch it. You know, I try to sometimes vet certain food things and cookbooks out until they're physically here in the world. How do we do?
On that note about suspense, we're going to have to end this conversation. Thank you so much to all of our panelists. That was great. Just wanted to thank again our Brooklyn Brewery, Squarespace, MailChimp, Oxford University Press, and Hemlock for making all this happen today.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.